Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast. Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Greetings, ladies and gents, and those with good sense. Welcome to another episode. In this show, we like to look at contradictions in history. And our guest today, Michael Foley, came up with a book idea that was sort of born of a contradiction. Michael is a professor of patristics, which is the study of early church fathers. But he's also a professor at Baylor University, which is a historically Baptist university. Because of that, they have a dry campus, with the idea that too much alcohol leads to drunkenness and intemperance and all sorts of sin. Well, Michael decided to write a book all about wine, beer, spirits, and pairing these things with the lives of saints and feast days on the Catholic Church calendar. Michael told me in this interview that unfortunately he couldn't have a cocktail as we were talking because he was working at Baylor campus that day. The story of how Michael came up with the idea of his book called Drinking with the Saints, The Sinner's Guide to a Holy Happy Hour was pretty interesting and born of not some sort of big idea, but really real life experience. He said that normally in the evening he shares cocktails with his wife, but one night she went out with friends and he'd been kicking around an idea of what he called a pious bartender's guide, which was built around the liturgical year or the Catholic Church calendar. And he spent the evening thinking about it. Then the idea came to him, and he thought, oh, I'll call it Drinking with the Saints. As soon as the idea came, he was on fire. He was able to write the introduction and the conclusion and pair Lives of Saints stories with cocktail recipes, some he looked up, some he invented on his own. So in this episode, we get into a really interesting discussion of the emergence of Christianity and what role alcohol had to play in that, and turns out quite a bit. Monks basically perfected beer. They didn't invent that, but they did invent Irish whiskey and typically use it for medicinal reasons. So wherever a monastery went and opened up, there would be a brewery or a distillery or a vineyard right along with it. So just to give you a couple of ideas of the cocktails that come up, one is St. Therese of Lisieux for October 3rd. And Therese put forth the idea of the concept of an elevator to God, offering small sacrifices each day. She said, I too would like to find an elevator to lift me up to Jesus, for I am too little to climb the rough stairway of perfection. So the drink for her is Love in an Elevator with gin, green curaçao liqueur, and ginger ale. Another cocktail, which I thought was awesomely weird, was the Lizard Skin, which is a flaming jigger of brandy served inside a hollowed out orange half. This is assigned to the feast of St. Francis Caracciolo. He once suffered from a rare skin disease, so the orange half is a nice way to give it some lizard skin. Anyway, this is a fascinating discussion on both mixology and history and how religion and drink can sometimes go together very well. Hope you enjoy this episode with Michael Foley.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? Ew, seriously. They squeeze the grease out of the wool and process it with chemicals, and then you eat it. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I got rid of products I didn't want anywhere near my body. I found that many multivitamins contain high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and even lacked some of the nutrients we actually needed. So what did I do? At 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. Ritual's products are made traceable, meaning we share the science and sourcing for every single ingredient. For example, our vegan vitamin D3 comes from sustainably harvested lichen in Nottingham, England, not sheep. We trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. See for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
You mentioned before we started recording this interview that even though we're going to be talking about cocktails and church history and the history of Christianity and alcohol, you can't have a cocktail in hand as we're talking. So can you explain why that is?
Well, that is because I teach at Baylor University, which is the world's oldest and largest Baptist university, and it is a dry campus. So despite all my writings on the subject, I respect my school's policy and do not have any liquor in my office.
I like to think, though, that the book got into the hands of an administrator and made them start to raise eyebrows. So there's at least that element.
Well, actually, the truth is all of my Baptist colleagues and even some folks in the administration have been very supportive. Not that they're going to change Baylor's policy anytime soon, but they think it's a fun idea. They don't get upset by it.
And I think that's really interesting with the idea of the book, where you're pairing saint stories with specific drinks, and especially where you're working. And I wonder what caused you to think of the idea for this book. It could be maybe where you're working, or there's also your research angle as a scholar of St. Augustine. How did the idea of this whole project come about originally?
Well, the basic idea of the book is to pair beer, wine, and cocktail suggestions with the different feast days of the church year. And my family and I have always loved to observe the customs of the church year, special festivities or foods for particular feasts. So we've always had that in our sort of daily lives. And my wife and I also enjoy a cocktail in the evening. So basically, it was only a matter of time before those two things converged.
Right. Yeah. So kind of a work of passion that got you into it originally?
Exactly. It was a nice, easy way to mark the church calendar.
Hmm. For you in your research, when you're looking at the life of St. Augustine, and he's a church father who is alive in the 400s in North Africa at the end of the Roman imperial period, anything historically sort of piqued your interest as you were looking into writing this?
Well, you're absolutely right. So my main focus is St. Augustine in my scholarship. And he is a patron saint of brewers, but it's not because he himself liked beer. I don't even know if he had any contact with beer as a Roman from North Africa. But it was because of the Augustinian order in the Middle Ages that brewed a lot of beer that he became a patron saint of brewing. Augustine was famous for being a sinner turned saint, and he recounts his sins in great detail in his great autobiography, The Confessions. But interestingly enough, of his many vices, drinking was not one of them. He mentions that he did not care for the taste of wine. He found it too sweet for his palate, and the wine back then was very sweet. So it's kind of interesting that of all his different vices, he never had a problem with the drink. But his family did apparently own a vineyard, which meant, like a lot of patrician Romans or upper class Romans, he would have been involved in winemaking, or at least his family. So he probably had some real life experience with the production of alcohol.
Hmm. Okay, so he would at least know how to make it. And is that how he not only became the patron saint of brewers, but the Augustinian order also brewed? Or how did that connect to him?
I really think it was accidental. I think that the Augustinians were very good at brewing beer, and they simply prayed to their patron, St. Augustine, and would feature, for example, pictures of St. Augustine on their beer labels. And I think as a result of that association, he became a patron saint of brewing. But I don't think there's any, I don't think the Augustinians paid attention to the fact that he would have had some knowledge of viniculture. And the reason why I say that is that it's only a very fleeting reference in the Confessions, where he just happens to mention that on his family's land was a vineyard, but nothing else is made of it.
Well, we've already done something helpful for homebrewers here. They know who the patron saint is, so if they need to petition anyone for help brewing their batch, they know who to go to.
It's right there,
yeah, St. Augustine. So, I mean, we're going to get into all sorts of historical asides like this. I mean, I have a ton of questions, but I suppose it helps to start at the beginning with this discussion. Your book idea might be new, but Christianity has had a long relationship with alcohol. There are references to it in the New Testament. But can you describe to me Christianity's relationship over the centuries with alcohol?
It's been there from the very beginning. Like you mentioned, drinking is mentioned in the Bible. Drunkenness is categorically condemned, but drinking in moderation is not. As a matter of fact, it is treated as a normal part of life. You see this all over the Old Testament with references to wine gladdening the heart of man. You see it at such great events as the wedding of Cana and, of course, the Last Supper. So wine is a normal part of the Judeo-Christian framework. And historically, that develops throughout church history. And I think one of the big reasons why it does develop is actually for health reasons. A lot of water prior to the 19th century was simply unsafe to drink. It was better to drink wine or what they called small beer. Small beer is beer that is low in alcoholic content. Some listeners may remember back in the day that you could buy 3.2 beer or 3.2 beer. In the U.S., that was sort of low alcohol beer. That you could be 18 in some states to buy 3.2 beer, but then you had to be 21 to buy beer with a normal amount of alcohol. So small beer was beer that was defined as beer that was fit for women, children, and day laborers, so that a day laborer could drink this beer without getting a real buzz. It wouldn't impede his rational activities or his motor control, but it was safer to drink than water. So throughout most of history, the church has had a sanguine attitude about, again, drinking in moderation because of its various health benefits.
There's even argument today amongst theologians that back then, it wasn't really wine, it was grape juice, which I don't particularly believe, but what would wine and beer have been like? There was 3.2 beer, as you mentioned. Would wine be similar to back then, the way it would be today? You said for Augustine, it was sweeter, and that's why he didn't like it. But in the Middle East, where the disciples are and the early Christians are, was it also like that?
It may have been sweet. The Bordeaux region of France, which produces a dry wine, is as old as the Romans. So we know that there was dry wine in antiquity, just as there was sweet wine. I think Augustine's main access was to sweet wine, judging by the way he described it. But the wine that they would have had in the New Testament times with the apostles, one thing we know for certain, it was definitely alcoholic. The idea that somehow there were two different two different substances in the Bible that are being referred to, grape juice on the one hand, wine on the other. There is no philological linguistic justification for that. Hmm. When St. Paul says, Paul uses one word, he uses oinos, which is the Greek word for wine. And when he says, be not drunk on oinos, he uses the word for wine, oinos. It is that same word that is used to describe the wine, for example, at the wedding of Cana. And that same word that's being used to describe the wine at the Last Supper. It's obviously alcoholic wine that they're talking about, because you can't get drunk on grape juice.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's always a interesting thing that even comes into denominational arguments today amongst different groups, or trying to proof text that no alcohol is ever allowed. With the growth and spread of Christianity, you mentioned that there was beer consumption and then wine consumption right from the beginning. As Christianity spreads out from the Middle East and into Europe and other places, and you see the growth of monasteries, and we get into time periods like St. Augustine, how does the relationship of alcohol with the church change that you can see?
Well, if anything, it develops, and it develops in large part because of the role of medieval monasteries coming up with different forms of alcohol. We've already mentioned that in the Middle Ages, monasteries were very crucial in developing brewing techniques. As a matter of fact, beer obviously predates Christianity. It was the ancient Babylonians who invented it. But a lot of our modern brewing techniques come from medieval monasteries. And to this day, the finest beer in the world is still brewed within the cloister, Trappist beer. It's outstanding. And I think there are now 12 or 13 Trappist monasteries that commercially produce beer. But besides beer, you also have the development of hard liquors. They were called aqua vitae, that were again developed for health reasons. Various kinds of herbal liqueurs were supposed to be helpful for a variety of ailments, and they often were. We think of alcohol today as somewhat dangerous for our health, and yet look at the contents of cough syrup. There's still alcohol in our remedies for colds. And so they were used, like the alcohol was used in the Middle Ages for that reason as well.
Hmm. How did monasteries perfect this brewing process? I'm a occasional home brewer, and a lot of them know about the famous Belgian Trappist ale. So there's a connection with monks and brewing. But what did they do to make the process better?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't know. I've only read other home brewers talk about this, and I am not a home brewer. I'm a consumer, not a producer. but I can at least say this, that both for the production of whiskey and herbal liqueur, as well as the production of beer, it kind of makes sense that development would take place in the monastery. Because the monastery was committed to the principle of ora et labora, work and pray, that everything a monk did, he did for the greater glory of God. He wasn't interested in cutting corners in order to maximize profits. What he did was a testimony to his love of God. And so you have this great care for excellence, this great attention to the craft. You also have great institutional stability. The monks aren't going anywhere. They're living in the cloister. They have their own fields of grain or grapes. And then you have an institutional memory. The monks are going to pass on this knowledge to the next generation. So you can see how the environment of the monastery would really lend itself to excellence in the bottle.
Hmm. I'm interested, too, with the growth of monasteries, and you talked about the Irish sharing their knowledge with the Scots during their missions. I know that during the time of Augustine, St. Patrick is working on Christianizing Ireland, And there's a book I read a long time ago by Thomas Cahill called How the Irish Saved Civilization.
Oh, right.
And he argues that in the 400s, when Ireland is Christianized, it goes out and builds up in monasteries in Europe, which in the 500s and 600s is falling apart because of the collapse of Rome. And it's right. entering what some call the Dark Ages. Historians don't like that term because they feel like it stacks the deck against the period. And now they call it the early medieval period. But are as these Irish monks are going out and planting these monasteries in areas that are being overrun by Goths and Ostrogoths and others, are they bringing along these brewing techniques with them? And that's sort of a rambling question of getting at this whole use of kind of alcohol as part of the economic engine of monasteries and rebuilding civilization. And how do you see alcohol production as part of this whole process?
I think it was part of the monks' general concern, interestingly enough, for health. I don't think it was necessarily a big money maker. I'm not entirely certain about that. But monasteries were the repository of knowledge, that they not only attended to spiritual things, but because they kept the manuscript traditions alive, they kept other forms of knowledge alive as well, including medicine. So people in the Middle Ages would turn to monks and to nuns. The convents were also very big repositories of knowledge for medicinal healing. And some of these, you know, St. Hildegard of Bingen, for example, was a very wise abbess, and some of her writings are still looked to today for their medical value. They had great knowledge of herbs in monastic gardens and this kind of thing. So I really think the development of aqua vitae, whiskey is the Celtic translation of aqua vitae, water of life. So aqua vitae is the Latin and whiskey is the Celtic for water of life. I think that they cultivated this for medicinal reasons, and then they brought that knowledge to other lands, like when they evangelized the Scots.
For the production of wine, was that mostly for, well, you need it to perform the Eucharist. Was that the main reason you see a lot of vineyards near monasteries?
Absolutely. And that also explains the rise of the wine industry in the New World, like the California wine industry, or the wine industry in Argentina or Australia. All of those great wine-growing regions got their start because of Catholic missionaries. It was the Franciscans who brought the first grapevines to California. And they did it not to establish a wine industry, obviously, but to celebrate the Mass. When you had these tenuous supply lines, when you were a missionary in the New World, you also needed to bring a knowledge of two things, how to make bread and how to make wine, in order to celebrate the central sacrament of Catholic life.
Okay, so you start to see that. And there's wine production in the Roman period, definitely. But do the growth of monasteries, do they accelerate and grow wine cultivation from what you saw?
Well, it's funny you should mention the Romans and wine, because I read one interesting theory. I don't know if it's true, but when you look at the map of the Roman Empire at its greatest point of expansion, it actually corresponds to all of the grape-growing regions of Europe and North Africa, that they basically did not extend their borders past where they could not cultivate wine.
That's an interesting chicken and the egg question of they couldn't grow because there was no wine, or because they couldn't have wine, they didn't bother to grow. So
Exactly. But somehow those two borders are somewhat coterminous, the political power of Rome and its wine. I don't know how the monks necessarily improved Roman techniques, but at the very least they preserved them. That there are, like I say, regions of France that have been around since Roman times and have been known as great centers of winemaking. But they definitely passed that knowledge on to the New World as well. And that's the part that I find sort of interesting, is bringing these ancient sort of Roman ideas of wine to places like California and Australia.
I love in your book these stories that you have about these unique characters who come up with new techniques, either new champagnes or developing other techniques to make hard alcohol. And one of them was a Benedictine monk. Could you tell that story? That was really interesting.
Yes. Yeah, so according to the legend, at least, the méthode champenoise, the ability to make fermented wine, was invented by a Benedictine monk whose name was Dom Pérignon. And of course, his name now adorns one of the world's finest champagnes. And according to the story, when he finally figured out how to have this second fermentation in the bottle that creates the carbon dioxide, which creates the bubbles, he shouted out to his fellow monks, "Brothers, come quickly. I'm drinking stars."
That's something to think about. And I don't know if Jay-Z and Beyonce have a champagne tower at some fancy gala that what they're drinking connects back to that. And also, you mentioned two Carthusian monks who keep a recipe. I'm really curious about this. Could you talk about that?
Well, the world's finest liqueur is considered to be chartreuse. It is the only alcohol that gave its name to a color rather than vice versa. And chartreuse is distilled and made in the charterhouse of the Carthusian order, which is located high in the French Alps. And according to the story, they've been making chartreuse for about 500 years, and they never write the recipe down. And only two monks at any given time know the recipe. It is a very tightly guarded secret. As a matter of fact, about 100 years ago, the French government was doing some kind of purge. They called it laïcité. They were laïcizing all sorts of church-owned property. And they actually had the audacity to kick the Carthusians out of their ancient home. And as they had kicked them out, they said to them, "Oh, and by the way, can you give us the recipe for chartreuse?" And the monks said, "Yeah, right," and just kept on walking. So the French government, basically this was a land grab, and they were hoping to do a government monopoly of chartreuse, but they couldn't get the recipe from the monks. So they actually hired botanists from French universities to scour through the monastery and look through the old warehouses and get little fragments of the herbs that were, you know, the crumbs of which were left, and to try to chemically reconstruct the recipe. And they tried this for about 30 years, making their own chartreuse, and they never got it. And the company that they set up went into bankruptcy. And when it did, the nearby townspeople bought the bankrupt company for a dollar and gave it to the monks. And the French government by that point admitted surrender, and the Carthusians were allowed to return and start producing real chartreuse again.
Have you tried chartreuse?
Oh yeah, it's outstanding. It's very potent. It's a very high proof. But if you take just small sips, you can experience a whole panoply of flavors going across your palate. And it is actually very good for you. I have a friend whose brother-in-law is a Carthusian monk right now in the monastery. And he tells me that when the monks get sick during the winter time, because they're in this really sort of drafty old castle, when they get sick, the first thing they do is take a tablespoon of chartreuse, and it will clear things right up.
There's a documentary I saw about Carthusians. It's either The Great Silence or Into Great Silence.
Yep.
This particular order, they never speak except for chanting the liturgy. And one day of the week, I think they'll actually talk to one another. Is that only, and the documentary takes place at this monastery in France. Is that right. for the entire Carthusian order or just this particular group in France?
No, I think that's for the entire order, that the Carthusians are among the more austere religious orders in the Catholic Church. So it is kind of ironic that they produce such a fantastic liqueur because their own lives are fairly abstemious.
Pretty easy for them to hide the recipe as well. So they're
that's
not,
right.
Yeah, they're not going to blab it to anyone anytime
they
soon.
They know how to keep their mouths shut.
Yeah. Have you paired that with other cocktails? It's sounds really interesting what you could get out of it.
It really is great. It's made from over 120 hand-picked herbs. The monks will go out to the French Alps and hand-pick 120 of these herbs and then arrange it in a recipe that, again, we don't know, and produce the chartreuse. Actually, it's the nearby town that does the actual distillation, but the monks sort of give them this herbal package to make. And it is good straight. It's good as a for medicinal purposes. It's good for a digestivo, but it can be used with cocktails as well. I'm almost reluctant to use it with cocktails because it's so good on its own that you hate to see it masked with other things, but there are a couple of really good cocktails that go with chartreuse. So it can be used well with a cocktail.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
I also think that's a really good example, what you described, of how technology gets lost. People have written that in Roman times they had concrete, or weapons makers will use things like Damascus steel, that the recipe's been lost to time. And that's exactly how it happens, like you described with these monks, that a lot of times those who worked with technology in ancient times, which was looked down upon by the theorists, they would orally transmit from one thing to another person because maybe the technology was used by a guild and they didn't want a rival guild to get it. Or
that's right.
For whatever reason, the Carthusians, I'm sure that, do you know the reason why they keep it such a closely guarded secret and don't put it into the public domain?
Well, I think their experience with the French government gives you the answer.
Yeah.
Right? That there are just a lot of people who would like to exploit the recipe, use maybe a cheaper, inferior knockoff version of it. So rightly so, they are keeping it a secret.
Yeah. So that if those two brothers, you know, God forbid, were killed in a train wreck, then it's gone. So, that's how technologies have been lost over time. So that's a little bit of living history right there.
That's right.
Yeah. And that was as it spreads to other places in the New World, what you described was really interesting. And there was another liqueur that the Benedictine DOM, could you also describe about how this came into existence?
That's true. So there is a liqueur called Benedictine, and the full name is Benedictine DOM, Deo Optimo Maximo, to God who is greatest and best. And the history of that is a little more controversial, but the first modern manufacturer of Benedictine was a Frenchman who claimed that he found this in a manuscript or a book that fell into his possession after the suppression of the monasteries during the French Revolution. So he claims that this was made by Benedictines before the French Revolution. And then, you know, the French Revolution, of course, confiscated many monasteries and killed and displaced many religious, and that somehow this came into his hands in the aftermath of that. It is, if it's not a true story, at least it is historically evocative. Benedictines did indeed make their own wine and their own herbal liqueurs quite often before the big modern political revolutions, which took a lot of their land away from them. So if it's not, if this recipe is not itself Benedictine, the spirit is certainly Benedictine.
Hmm. Okay. I want to ask you about the way that alcohol was used in church celebrations. Let's step outside the walls of a monastery and look at culture in the Middle Ages in Europe, to pick one particular place. How was it used? Of course, it was used in Eucharistic celebrations, but let's say feast days or public celebrations or other public communal events that would be a part of the church life or church calendar. How did different drinks factor into all of that?
Well, I don't think they'd nailed anything down in terms of a formal protocol or a formal ritual. I think that the church simply baptized whatever local healthy habits there were regarding eating and drinking. And of course, the church has always emphasized moderation with these things. But one thing I did notice in my research was that a lot of the seasonal beers, a lot of the age-old techniques began to be coordinated in light of the church year. So for example, today we have things like winter ales and summer ales for the different natural seasons. In the Middle Ages, they would have called that a Christmas ale or a St. Thomas ale after St. Thomas the Apostle, whose feast was on December 21st. And then instead of a summer ale, they called it Whitsun ale. Whit Sunday was the old name for Pentecost, and Pentecost usually fell around the beginning of summer. And there actually is a microbrew in Michigan that makes a Whitsun ale in honor of this medieval tradition. So they were thinking in terms of the liturgical seasons when they brewed their beer or made their wine.
Hmm. What's interesting about this whole thing is that I would guess at first blanche, when people hear about the topic of your book, that it seems a little bit counterintuitive of, oh, church days and drinking, and then the sinner, what's the subtitle? The Sinner's Guide to
a Holy Happy Hour.
Right, Holy Happy Hour. So I really like that. But there's a little bit of kind of a wink and a counterintuitiveness to it, because they wouldn't expect a drinking guide to go along with stories of saints and how they brought it about. Partly, I think there's something that changes sort of historically, where in the modern era with temperance movements and teetotalerism, that drinking among some circles can just be seen as bad. So what changes from monks and other groups producing alcohol, thinking this is medicinal or it has some sort of good to society, and that's why we do this, to now, right, where the idea can seem a bit counterintuitive? What changes?
You know, I honestly don't know. It's something I would love to actually have a better sense of. I can tell you this much. It's not necessarily the Reformation, because both Luther and Calvin were drinkers. They had no objection to it. As a matter of fact, I heard that Martin Luther, who was a good German who enjoyed his beer, would play drinking games with the Our Father. And I'm not quite sure how he did it, and I've only heard this secondhand from a friend of mine. But yeah, apparently Luther had no problem with it. Calvin was a Frenchman, studied in Paris, had no problem drinking wine. I think it was a few things that led to a change in attitude. One was the introduction, probably, of certain hard liquors, such as gin. When gin became a big deal, it was in Holland, but then it crossed the English Channel and the English started to drink gin. When gin was first introduced into England, it basically was the crack cocaine of its time. The lower classes glommed onto it and just went crazy. And apparently there was just a huge spike in violence and in idleness and in all kinds of vice as a result of gin. So I think it was reactions to dramatic abuses of alcohol that led to the pendulum sort of swinging in the opposite direction. And I also suspect it was the advent of modern water treatment plants that made it possible for you to be a teetotaler. I mean, before, it would have been bad for your health to be a teetotaler. Even just putting a little bit of alcohol in your water supply would kill those waterborne pathogens. And so you needed just a little bit of alcohol for, again, health reasons. But once you get modern water treatment plants, you don't need to put alcohol in your drink anymore. And then you have the liberty of being a teetotaler. So I think some of those were part of the historical reason for the shift to temperance movements.
When gin comes about, is part of the reason it spreads so far and wide and amongst lower classes, is that because it's cheaper than other hard drinks?
It must have been that it was easier to produce. Whiskey takes time to age. There's this craft that goes into it. You've got to keep it in the barrels for a certain period of time. Whereas gin can be distilled quickly and distributed quickly.
Okay. So that's part of the reason. And if the water's already being treated, then there's not as much of a need for it. It sounds also that when you have tried some of these older drinks, something either made in the style of a medieval drink, it sounds a lot more herbal than something of today. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Hard liquor was not that big a deal in the Middle Ages. You had whiskey in the northern countries, but you really didn't have it in the southern countries. You did probably have grappa, but usually it was beer and wine was the staple of the Middle Ages, particularly beer. Its nickname in the Middle Ages was liquid bread because of its nutritional value. They even brewed special kinds of beer during Lent that were extra rich in nutrients to compensate for the rigors of the Lenten fast. And we still actually have that beer today. It's called Doppelbock, and it's a style of beer.
Yeah, I really like that style.
So it's really only in modernity that you start to get all these other kinds of hard liquors. And I think that maybe sort of complicated the Christian embrace of alcohol, if you will.
I've only had, one kind of floral style hard drink that you've mentioned. And this was when I was in Hungary. It's a drink called Unicum that apparently the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, he described it as such a unique taste. And I think it was either his pharmacist who came up with it for medicinal reasons. I liked it. Other people thought, oh, this is kind of weird. Again, they would describe it's like a hard liquor IPA, but in your experiments with mixology, do you have any herbal drinks that would be available in the United States that you would recommend and any cocktails that have come out of them that you think turned out quite well?
Yes. Let me think. I was asked a couple of years ago when Pope Francis visited the United States to make a cocktail in honor of his visit. And so I made something called the Taste of Mercy, and it had the Argentines love a very bitter Italian herbal liqueur called Fernet Branco or Blanco or something like that. It is awful when taken neat. It's just a punch in the face. They swear by it. They drink it neat at their Argentine barbecues, and they claim it's a great cure for a hangover. But I did mix that with I think some grenadine and some bourbon, and it was quite good. It was quite good. So even that's the neat thing about cocktails. You can have a bitter element in it. You can have bitters in them, and they can still contribute to a good flavor profile.
Oh yeah, that's a good way to describe it, that the herbal is sort of a bitter, but in drink form.
Exactly. At least some forms of herbal liqueur can be quite bitter. Chartreuse is not, but this Fernet Branco really was.
Good way to rescue it. They can be pretty rough if you have them straight.
Yep.
Can you tell me about, as you have talked with people in the wake of releasing this book, how has it been received? Has it just been something amongst Catholic circles or also amongst Protestant circles, even those that would have more of a temperance legacy to their denomination?
I've been very pleased by the reception of the book, and I've been surprised by its ecumenical reception. I didn't expect any significant blowback from Anglicans or Episcopalians. As a matter of fact, we did an event in downtown Waco, and the largest group that showed up were Episcopalians, and they described themselves as Whiskeypalians. but the Baptist reaction has been really good as well. My Baptist friends think it's a charming idea. They actually enjoy not only learning about the array of drinks, but also about the array of saints, that this is not something that they would normally have on their radar either. And so it's been a nice surprise to see the kind of reception that the book has gotten.
If some people have asked you, well, do you think this could somehow promote, I don't know, drunkenness or debauchery? What have you said to people if they ask you that question?
I have not received it as a question. I've received it as an accusation. I've gotten some angry messages saying, you're glorifying drunkenness. And so this happened just a few months ago. And so I asked the person, could you please tell me what part of the book do you think glorifies drunkenness? Where do I glorify it? And he said, well, I haven't actually looked at the book. I've only looked at its cover.
Always the best criticisms right there.
Exactly. And I wrote back saying, well, have you heard the adage that you can't judge a book by its cover? I think anyone who has actually seen the book, especially my introduction where I talk about the importance of moderation, knows that the point is not to glorify drunkenness or encourage it in any way. If anything, my book is geared towards the opposite, to discourage drunkenness. I think that if you really are mindful when you drink, an inbuilt encouragement to be moderate. It's when you're absent-minded. It's when you're either drinking to forget or you're not actually enjoying the flavor of the drink. You're just drinking to get drunk. So you're just sort of mindlessly downing one drink after another. That's when you run into problems. But when you slow it down, when you are drinking to remember something good, when you're drinking to savor the drink, and when you're drinking with friends, which is another point of the book, when those things happen, I think you've got an added incentive for moderation.
That reminds me of a lot of G.K. Chesterton quotes where he says, let us honor the Lord with beer and burgundy by not drinking too much of it.
Exactly.
Which I think I saw etched on somebody's stein or a highball glass that he had.
That's a good place to put it.
Now, I want to get into really kind of the heart of your book. We mentioned the historical context, which I'm always interested in, but you dig into a lot of pairing drinks with particular feast days. And how did you decide which drinks should go with which feast days?
It really varied. With the modern saints, it was easier to know what they drank because we have more extensive information about them. So for St. John Paul II, Pope John Paul was recently canonized. We have a very extensive biography of him, and we know what his drinking habits were. He, unlike most Poles, did not favor vodka, didn't care much for it, but he did enjoy a little white wine cut with water and in great moderation. And we know this on the testimony of the KGB, that when he was Archbishop of Krakow, they spied on him and they kept an extensive dossier of his habits. They did this with all the Polish clerics because they were hoping to find things to blackmail priests with. And so they were disappointed to find that they couldn't find anything to blackmail him with. He was a moderate drinker. He didn't have any other vices. But they did catalog what he did and did not drink. So for the modern saints, it was somewhat easier to find a pairing. With the ancient saints, it was a little more difficult. And basically, I just looked for some kind of connection. Maybe the saint came from a particular region that's famous for a particular drink. Or maybe it was a symbol in Christian art that they are associated with, like a pomegranate. Well, if the saint is associated with a pomegranate, we can give him a drink with grenadine, which is made from pomegranate. Some connection like that.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
What were some of the most interesting cocktails you'd say that you discovered?
Well, I can definitely say the most bizarre was a cocktail called the lizard skin. And it is warmed brandy served in a hollowed out orange rind. So you take half an orange, you hollow it out to leave nothing but the rind, and then you pour warm brandy in it, and that's a lizard skin. It's totally bizarre.
What did you assign it to?
Well, the reason why I did assign it was that there is a particular saint who had a skin disease that was apparently made his skin a little scaly, and then he promised God, if you get rid of this awful skin disease, I'll become a priest. And God fulfilled his end of the bargain, so the man fulfilled his end as well and became a priest and a saint. So we gave him the lizard skin drink.
You have to mention the drink paired with Saint Agatha. I thought this was good.
Yes, that's perhaps the cheekiest entry of the book. But Saint Agatha is often featured in Christian art, holding a pair of her severed breasts on a tray, because according to tradition, this was the way she was martyred. And so I found an old cocktail called Twin Peaks and assigned it to her.
So I'm sure you'll get, have you gotten any blowback from very, very traditional or stodgy or conservative Catholics?
Actually, not so much. You say traditional or conservative. It's odd that it sort of cut across those lines. I did get some mild blowback from Catholics, but oddly enough, not so much from a conservative point of view, but a cultural one. There are Catholics who were brought up in the South, brought up perhaps in a Protestant milieu, and they have started to think like their Protestant brethren. And so they sort of, in the drinking water, imbibed the same kind of negative attitudes. And so they reacted kind of on those cultural grounds rather than on a theological ground.
And this is something I always like to ask authors of books, because you have to spend hundreds and hundreds of hours digging into the subject, looking at documents. Sometimes you research something and you see it won't fit into the book. So you learned it, but you have to still cast it aside. So you accumulate all this information. And what would you say that you really got out of this process that kind of surprised you looking at the history of the Catholic Church and alcohol across the centuries that you wouldn't have expected to find when you first started researching it?
Well, I expected lessons in what to drink and in what was drunk, but I did not expect to find a lesson in how to drink. And that was one of the neat surprises of the book. And it was really only after the book was published that it occurred to me that I learned something about, in a sense, the sacramental act of drinking. By sacramental, I don't mean that having a beer is an act of grace, but the idea of a sacramental sensibility or a sacramental imagination is that you see the entire world, you see all of God's creation as infused with his goodness and his kindness. And that includes the contents of your glass. So after the book came out, I wrote an article called How to Drink Like a Saint. And I now give talks with that title around the country. And I give five ways to drink like a saint. And these are the lessons that I learned as a result of researching this book. And the talk is really well received. I think people really connect to it because there is a way in which when drinking becomes a part of authentic Christian merriment, it takes on a sense almost of something blessed.
What are those five ways?
Well, we've already talked about a couple of them in one way or another. Drink with moderation, drink with memory. Make sure that you are drinking to remember and not drinking to forget. Drink with gratitude. Drink with merriment. And by merriment, I mean fellowship, not just having fun, but making merry in a community. And then finally, drink with ritual. Have a sense of a ritual protocol to your event. And it needn't be something elaborate. It can actually be something as simple as a toast. And when that happens, it adds an extra dimension and focus to your celebration.
These principles, did you get them because you saw that particular saints would practice them, or was it something that they would specifically prescribe or something that in your own experience you thought was good to do?
I think it was more from just sort of observing the practices or seeing how alcohol was used responsibly. And even with the ritual element, I noticed that there are several blessings for beer and wine in the old Book of Blessings that the Catholic Church traditionally used. And these spoke of memory and God's goodness and health and blessings of merriment. So it was based on that sort of testimony that I was able to put together these five things.
Did you see examples of monks or abbots or church fathers doing these things? I know that sources typically don't spit out things like this, especially medieval ones, but a toast that someone gave, or the brothers getting together to commemorate something, or did you ever come across anything like that?
You know, I didn't look too hard, but I didn't see much from the Middle Ages. It's only when you get to sort of after the printing press that you start getting books on toasts and things like that. Those are very popular during the Victorian era, for example. In the early church, toasting was frowned upon. Augustine actually condemns toasting. But the reason is because it was heavily associated at the time with paganism, that it was the pagans who would toast and then they would pour a libation or a part of their drink onto the ground for the gods. And so in Augustine's day, it had a very, very negative connotation. But once the old gods are dead, the connotation dies with it, and now it can be baptized and used as a Christian ritual.
I'm a member of a local Toastmasters group, so I'll definitely have to mention that the next time that
Excellent.
I have a chance to do that. Okay, that's great. Yeah, that's another good point there, that when people imagine what historians do, they imagine that old records are like the records we have today, except using folksier or different language. But they don't get that it was pretty hard to produce written material, so you really had to focus on the core elements of abstract theology or scripture or whatever, and you couldn't get into these, you know, nice narrative moments that were nice but secondary to other more important works.
Right, exactly.
So what is the main message you would say that you would like readers to take away from Drinking with the Saints?
I think the main message would be that obviously you can enjoy alcohol as a good Christian, and that you can make it part of an experience of merriment and fellowship. And in our increasingly atomized world, where we seem to be, the old tight-knit communities seem to be dissolving, I think that kind of merriment and that kind of reconnection with each other is very important. And so I do hope the book is helpful in encouraging authentic Christian merriment.
And a last question, this is a good practical one. For those types of special occasions or merriments, gathering with friends, whatever, do you have any go-to drink that you always know, okay, in a pinch, this is the one that's best to use?
There's no one drink I think that will appeal to everyone's tastes. I am, at the end of the day, am simply a martini man. That is my sort of go-to drink. For my wife, it's an old-fashioned. So we have sort of a mixed marriage in that respect. But yeah, people have a certain go-to cocktail. I would say, you know, stick with what works for you.
Any recommendation of gin or vodka or however you make it that you say, yeah, I would go with this?
Again, tastes vary on that. And it also depends on your budget. You know, with gin, Bombay and Tanqueray are outstanding. But I also think as an everyday gin, Gordon's is fine. I mean, one of the neat things about cocktails is that they were designed in part and became popular during Prohibition, because during Prohibition, you often had inferior alcohol to deal with. It was bootlegged and made in the bathtub or whatever. And the beauty of a cocktail is that it doesn't need to start with superior ingredients the way that a whiskey does. That the idea is that you use several different ingredients to mask the inferiority of the original products, that you blend things in such a way that you can actually get a superior drink from inferior ingredients. So yes, it does matter to some extent what you put into the drink, but the idea of a cocktail is that it can hide some of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and take something base, but then turn it into something better, which maybe is a nice metaphor for a lot of the things you're getting into.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you very much for all this information. And I'll have a link to your book and all the other resources that you mentioned on the show notes for this episode. So thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott.
That was the episode with Michael Foley. If you would like to learn more, you can go to drinkingwiththesaints.com or the Drinking with the Saints Facebook page. You can also come to historyonthenet.com and find all of this information in the show notes for this episode. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplugged to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.